From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition, and I'm Jason Dole. I want to thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, we'll learn more about the HEAT Act in New York. One of the people who are trying to help folks out with that. But before we get to that, we've got the latest news from the River Reporter. For that, we turn to Ruby Rayner. I spoke to Ruby earlier today. This is a big one because Camp FIMFO is back in the news. The first time I've been talking about it in a while. And now the public will be the next to weigh in on the environmental impact of the Camp FIMFO project. And this is after the Highland Planning Board voted unanimously to accept an updated draft of an environmental impact statement. Draft environmental impact statement, DEIS. This is just the next step in a long process of review of the project that's been going on and happening before the planning board in the town of Highland, a process that's so long, in fact, I needed a real refresher on where we are in the process right now. And in case you need that too, this is where Ruby starts us off.
The DEIS, so the Draft Environmental Impact Statement, is intended to assess the potential environmental impact of the project. And that DEIS was submitted by Camp FIMFO in June of this year. And then there was this opportunity for the planning board who's reviewing it to then ask for points of further clarification or ask for follow-up questions. And in addition to the planning board, there was a couple of other organizations also asking different points of clarifications from Camp FIMFO, the applicant, the National Park Service, the Upper Delaware Council, and then Keystone Engineering, who was hired by the planning board to review this project. So they had, you know, an 11-page list of all of these different points where they were looking for more information or more clarification from the applicant. And now they've come to the point where they believe that those asks that they have been satisfied within the scope. And so they then voted to accept that draft environmental impact statement, which moves us to the next point of this overall seeker process. That's what the overall process that we're, the part of the process that we're in right now, which is where, like I said, the public can now weigh in themselves. So that's the overview and how we got to where we are in terms of this small bit of it.
Yeah, do you have any examples of what some of those things were broadly?
Yeah. So like I said, there was like 11 pages of kind of these, this mix of questions, points of clarification, et cetera. And a lot of them revolved around the defining temporary and permanent RVs. So to give a little bit, just so that makes sense, the project itself is transforming the Kittatinny Campground in Berryville into a resort with hundreds of RV park models, which are small mobile units with bathrooms and kitchens that are not weatherized for winter. And each park model has its own sewer and water hookup, which will remain stationed at a specific location on the campground. And there's been some contention around, you know, because it's hooked up to water and sewer, because of the question of permanence or impermanence, does this fit? Is this an RV? Is this not? So there was some points of clarification that were asked in for the applicant to define whether the RVs are temporary or permanent. There was questions about capacity. So the number of people and the number of users of the proposed project for points of, like, you know, defining the numbers more rigidly than they originally did in the DEIS application. Questions about rain flood plans, asking for more details regarding the impact of the project. They asked for additional information in terms of contingency plans, specifically for mitigation in the case of maybe an emergency and how that would affect, you know, local EMS resources and other stuff like that. Okay. And they also asked for more information of like community impact of the project. So if there was any resources or anything that the applicant of Camp FIMFO might want to include that they would provide the community if this project was to go through.
All right. Well, that brings me up to date to what I remember of the story. So again, just to go back to what you're saying earlier, the fact that that's what was needed, that's what's in this this DEIS, Draft Environmental Impact Statement. That's why the public can weigh in now, because this company has come back to address some of those issues in this statement, correct?
Right. And I think an important point, sorry, of clarification there is that it doesn't necessarily mean that the answer from the applicant, Camp Finfo, is something that the planning board member would agree with or not agree with. It's just so much so that they've satisfied the question. They have answered it. So that's just a point there. It's not that the planning board, by accepting the draft EIS, is saying,
yes,
okay, we agree. It's that they have sufficiently answered the questions laid out.
And now, as you said, the public will be weighing in. So again, let's remind people, how can folks weigh in on this process?
So there's written public comments that can be accepted until at least January 10th. There's a possibility that that might be extended, but for now, till January 10th, you can find through online on the Highland Town website. And then there will also be a public hearing conducted next week on December 18th at 6 p.m. in the Eldred High School gym.
So moving on to the next story, Ruby, it's raining right now. Does this mean that we're done with all of the drought risks that we were hearing so much about in the past month or so?
Not quite. So exactly like you said, that there's been all these drought risks and drought-like conditions, and now we've had rain for a couple of days, so it might seem like we are in the clear and we have moved on from those risks. But according to the Delaware River Basin Commission, though they have not still declared a water supply emergency, they are preparing for the continued risk of a water emergency. And so they have put on these preliminary breaks that there could be a water supply emergency and are continuing to manage the conditions, which are dry conditions, despite it looking like it is raining out. And over the past 90 days, the Upper Delaware River Basin has received 8 inches less precipitation than the average, and the Lower Delaware River Basin has received 10 inches less. So they are still declaring that widespread drought condition, and there's only two counties, Wayne and Lackawanna in Pennsylvania, that are under normal conditions along the Delaware. And they are looking at the reservoirs, determining whether there will be this water emergency, is that they're keeping track of the reservoirs in Neversink, Papacton, and Cannonsville, which feeds into New York City's water supply, to monitor whether there will be a river-wide drought declaration by the DRBC. And currently, those are less than 42%, which comparatively, typically at this time of year, those are all at around 51.8% full. And so if they fall below a certain threshold past that for more than 5 days, the DRBC is planning to then declare a river-wide drought declaration. So that's what they're still keeping track, and they're not yet, they're still very much making plans to declare a river-wide drought declaration, despite the rain that has been going on for the past couple of days. So it's still something that is teetering and that they're looking out for and monitoring these different basins.
Is there a time frame in which that would happen or must happen?
As of now, they're reducing the amount of water that is being released from the reservoirs to try to slow down the process and prevent the river-wide drought declaration. But if the water stays below that level, that 42% level, for 5 consecutive days, that's what would trigger a further river-wide drought declaration.
Okay, well, we'll definitely be keeping an ear out for that then. Finally, I know you were out at a community event that, full disclosure, I was also at. We had our One Small Step Radio Catskill. One Small Step, it's a part of this national initiative. There's 7 stations around the country that have been working on this project. We've been getting the word out. We are still looking for people to participate in this, and I'll remind people again at the end of our conversation. But as part of this whole process, we had a listening party kind of showing the community what we've been doing and what it's about. And you were there to cover it. Is that right?
That's correct.
So what did you think?
Yeah, I had an opportunity to speak with the team behind producing the project, Judy Balaban, Isabel Breverman, and Ronald Kelson, prior to the event. And I was able to speak to some of the participants in One Small Step, which is, a series of conversations between different people who might not otherwise sit down and talk to one another, rooted in them having different political beliefs, but the conversation not being political necessarily in nature. And so it was really, really interesting to talk to some of the participants themselves about their experience and why they decided to, apply to participate in One Small Step and what they kind of thought in reflection of their experience. I talked to one of the participants, Elizabeth Williams, who this quote from her I really love, so I'll read it here. She said, quote, "If we can't find the humanity in each other, then I really think we're screwed." So she said that she really enjoyed participating in One Small Step, and that she had so many moments when her and her partner both agreed on so much, which surprised her. She was saying how, they were both quite different and they had different political beliefs, but that she didn't realize that there were so many points of similarity, despite being opposites on the political spectrum, and that they had a lot in common. And that provided her with hope, where though she might understand how they found themselves to have different political beliefs and be so often oppositional to one another, that realizing and for herself keeping in mind the fact that they had a lot of shared common goals was something that was motivational, in that there could be a future for more collaboration between folks who maybe don't have the same political beliefs. And I thought she was very earnest in explaining that and how she's been reflecting a lot on the experience and that how it's taught her a lot. And that's really also the same came from the different members of who produced the project. Braverman and Kelson and Babylon, they all said that they've kind of like learned themselves to take a second and listen before jumping to a conclusion based on, some aspect of a person, because they found in recording these conversations with people that they were always surprised in the direction that they went and what they ended up learning about people through what they shared. So it was really interesting to hear some takeaways from the participants and the folks who created the project themselves. And it seemed like it achieved very much of the goals. It's obvious how necessary, I guess, and uncommon it is that two people who are maybe different in many demographic ways actually sit down and talk to each other, based on the reactions that I heard from people who have listened to it and people who participated in it. So it seems like it's a space that was, that needs to be filled, and that this specific project did a pretty good job of making an effort to fill it in some ways.
The one thing that you said a word in there that has been exactly how I've been approaching this, which is this is very necessary. Although I don't think I am the right person to do it, so it's a good thing that I'm not the one who's doing it. I'm really appreciative of the people who are doing it and making this happen. It's just been a great thing to see it happening. I don't want to talk about it in the past like this, though, because we have not yet gotten all the interviews that we need to get for this project. And we still have time to record these interviews before the project ends, I think, at the end of the month. So if you are interested in participating in this thing that you've heard Ruby and me talking about here, it's called One Small Step. Go to WJFFradio.org. WJFFradio.org. Scroll down. There's a red square icon that says One Small Step in big white letters. Click on that, and I will also say that part of this is you want to have people of different political backgrounds, broadly speaking, kind of a left background, kind of a right background, and we are definitely looking for some more people that are more towards the right to be part of this conversation. So if you know anybody that fits that description, or if you yourself fit that description, check it out. Tell them to go to WJFFradio.org or check it out for yourself. WJFFradio.org, One Small Step. Ruby, thank you for letting me give a big pitch for this one more time here on air. And thank you for all the news that you brought to us today.
Thank you.
All those stories are up now at riverreporter.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to learn about the HEAT Act. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I even told my editors there was absolutely no way this would happen in 5 years. And it turns out I was wrong again. And here we are, 5 years later. Notre Dame has been reopened. It's on time, on budget, and it's incredible. It's a kind of miracle.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the new exotic sounds of the Tiger Club, vibraphonist Mark Riddle, and the Martini Kings. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join us where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. As we mentioned yesterday, New York Governor Kathy Hochul will be laying out her vision for the next year in the Empire State at her State of the State address happening next month, January 14th. And that kicks off the budgeting process in Albany. And in preparation for that, climate, health, and environmental activists across New York are now calling on Hochul to take decisive leadership on climate and affordability by including funding for the New York Home Energy Affordable Transition Act, also known as the HEAT Act, in her proposed executive budget. To find out more about HEAT, Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke to Lisa Marshall, Advocacy and Organizing Director of New Yorkers for Clean Power, about this bill.
The whole idea behind the New York HEAT Act is cleaner heat and lower bills for New Yorkers. What that means is right now, New York's law has utilities locked into providing one kind of heating option for New Yorkers, which is natural gas. And we call it the gas mandate. The New York HEAT Act actually changes that so that the utilities could pay for cleaner heating options like heat pumps for customers. And at the same time, it provides an affordability guarantee. There are over a million New York households that are behind on their bills and heavily energy burdened in New York. And we need to provide relief for those New Yorkers. So the New York HEAT Act limits what you would pay for energy to 6% of the household income. And this would provide an average of $136 per month relief to those households that are energy burdened. That's, as I said, I think it's about 1.4 million New York households that would see bill relief after we pass the New York HEAT Act.
Okay. So is there some crossover between the what we have now, the HEAP, which is helps folks either winterize their home or help in emergencies, paying for emergency repairs or heating bills? It seems like there's some overlap a little bit, or no?
That's such a great question. There are actually several programs, including HEAP. HEAP is the most important one that helped out folks on their energy bills. There's also the Energy Affordability Enrollment Program. But those programs are not meeting the needs of New Yorkers around their heating bills in an adequate way. And it is actually the policy of New York that any household should not pay more than 6% of its income on energy. And this would take that policy and would require the agencies that oversee our energy system to create a policy to make sure that everybody was included and nobody was left out. And with HEAP, your household has to find out about HEAP, have the wherewithal to enroll in HEAP, and keep enrolling. Every year you have to keep applying. If you want the summer HEAP for cooling, you have to apply that separately. If you need your furnace or boiler tuned, you have to apply for that separately. It's a very burdensome program. We're very grateful to have the money that's in HEAP, but that isn't really reaching the needs of every New York household on energy. So the New York HEAT Act would do something much more powerful in terms of providing bill relief. And then there's also this other element to it, the cleaner heat element, which would allow our utility money that we spend, the extra tax basically that everybody spends on the utility bill, allow that to go towards clean heating solutions instead of continuing to pay for more and more fossil fuel pipelines and infrastructure that we really can't afford. Right now, the utility companies are not even allowed to invest in these clean heating solutions, even though we have a climate law that says that they should. These laws are in conflict with each other, and until we pass New York Heat, we won't resolve that conflict.
Right. Really, the New York Heat Act, it seems like it plays more into exactly what the New York State's goals are for clean energy going to the future. How do you, you know, do you see that happening sooner than later, sort of the shift away from fossil fuel infrastructures to more clean energy technology?
Yeah, you know, the shift has to be gradual. It can't happen overnight. And what the New York Heat Act actually allows is for us to make a sensible plan to make that shift so that it's as seamless and painless as possible for New Yorkers. Right now, what's happening is people who are climate aware or who have enough money are already getting off the gas system. And that leaves more and more people stuck on the gas system, paying more and more for that gas system because there's no plan. It's just up to you whether you put heat pumps in or not. So this would allow us to what we call to right-size the gas system, to allocate gas towards those industries and manufacturing where it's really needed, and to think about the gas system as a system. Where can we start to pare back the outer branches of that tree, replace, instead of replacing old gas pipes with new gas pipes, we could look at those places and say, okay, in 5 years, that gas pipe was going to be replaced. Now, instead, we're going to plan on weatherizing all the buildings on that line and providing everybody with heat pumps and efficient electric appliances instead of spending billions on putting a new pipe in the ground. So that's what New York Heat Act would allow us to do. The transition itself, it is always going to have to be fairly slow. It's just a takes time. It's not something that happens overnight. We're really talking about the next 2 decades, 3 decades to slowly transition New York's buildings off of these fossil fuels.
You just mentioned buildings because we're living in sort of two worlds in a way, downstate and upstate, because the needs for the city are completely different from the needs for, say, rural areas like we are here in Sullivan County. I remember I used to live in the city, and I was in real estate in the city. And I remember before I moved out, there was a transition from oil heat to gas heat because it was more reliable. But I know it was very expensive for the property managers, and it was a small property managers. The big talk, and when I'm relating that to also to heat rule here, to switch over to, let's say, a gas boiler or to an oil boiler to more energy efficient heat pumps, there's a great cost for that to happen. How does the New York Heat Act help folks who want to be in more cleaner energy but yet can't really afford, say, a heat pump or something else to sort of offset what they're doing with the fossil fuel now that they have now?
Yeah, I think you've put your finger right on the key issue here is when you're thinking about in the Southern Tier where we live, I live in the Southern Tier as well, lots of people are on oil, and we don't want to see people paying for new gas pipes, converting from gas, and then convert to heat pumps. We want to go straight from oil or propane to heat pumps. The great advantage is that will make people money right off the bat. As soon as you replace the propane, the oil, the heat, you're going to save money. You're also going to have a conditioner rod for. You're going to have cleaner air in your home. There's just so many advantages. But what you pointed out is quite right. Most people can't afford, even with the incentives and the tax credits and the rebates that we have, most people can't afford to do that. When we pass the New York Heat Act, we're actually going to free up utility money that's currently being used to build and maintain gas pipes to put money right into people's homes, pay for those heat pumps, pay for the electrical upgrades, pay for the insulation, pay for a new stove. So you have a lot of advantages to passing New York Heat, both upstate and downstate. It is more complicated in the densely populated areas like New York City. But for our upstate neighborhoods, it just provides this immediate benefit. As soon as we can get off oil and propane, we can see households saving thousands of dollars a year. And I've seen it happen. And I live in Chemung County, a couple counties over for you. I've seen many people realize these benefits, both to their lifestyle, their comfort, their health, and just love going off of the oil and the propane and going to the heat pumps.
Now, starting today, you had, I guess we call them, not protests, but demonstrations, supporting the HEAT Act. You had one happen today on December 11th at 11 a.m. in Williamsville. And tomorrow, the nearest one to us is Kingston and Binghamton. This sort of, what would you describe them? Demonstrations, support gatherings?
We are calling this a statewide week of action to show how much support there is out there for the New York HEAT Act and to make sure that Governor Hochul is aware that people are really counting on her to be a climate leader, especially in this time where we know there's no climate leadership coming out of Washington, D.C. It's on the state to lead now. And so all across New York, from Buffalo to Long Island, and over the starting today and ending next Wednesday, there are going to be different kinds of actions. We have all different kinds. Some of them are press conferences. Some are energy affordability workshops. We have a movie screening. We have demonstration of affordable housing that's all electric. The Binghamton event is actually a private home tour of a home that has been electrified. And so you have to RSVP and make sure that we know you're a real person who really wants to go if you want to go to that event, because you can't put their address on the website. But yes, I think we have been able to get commitments in the past from the governor, but we really need her to stand up this year more than ever before. And so this week of action is really to get our message out there for cleaning your heat and lower bills, and make sure the governor's office and the legislature hear us, because this, we can't afford another year of not passing this bill to provide relief and start to really plan a just, equitable, and swift transition off of fossil fuels.
I had a question of, given the current political climate, we have one administration that's coming in that's not really pro-fossil fuel. How do you see going in over the next 4 years? New York, obviously, is all up to the states, and we have a Democratic governor who seems, to me, at least more pro-clean energy. How do you see it going the next 4 years as far as, like, when you have the central government going against clean energy?
Surprisingly, we're somewhat optimistic, because the last time we had a drill baby drill administration in Washington, New York really took giant leaps forward in for climate and clean energy by passing our landmark climate law, the CLCPA, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. I think that anyone who understands the severity of the climate crisis, which I think is more and more people every day, we just saw these terrible wildfires all around the state at the end of the summer and then the fall because of the drought. And we experienced the unbreathable air last summer. That was really quite terrifying, and many other things, including some awful flooding. We had the Amtrak service disrupted, et cetera. I think more and more people really have seen that the climate crisis is coming to New York. It's here. And that New York can act. Some might say we're just a state, but we're the 11th biggest economy in the world. What we do here in New York matters. We could just as easily be Germany. We can do quite a lot here in New York. We can really have an impact. We're one of the biggest users of natural gas, even though we banned fracking. We are one of the biggest consumers of fracked gas. And so we need to start to take steps to turn that around. And we can do that. We have a Democratic governor. She traveled to see the Pope to get an award on climate. She just really needs to stand up and actually move forward her own state's policy in order to really be viewed nationally and globally as a real climate leader. So we're really looking to her for that kind of leadership. The rhetoric, the actions need to catch up a little bit with the rhetoric, I'd say. And making change is hard. Leading is hard. No one's saying it's easy. But I think when we see a president or a president-elect go on TV and say that his top priority is drill, baby, drill, then a state like New York, states like California and Washington need to work, and Massachusetts need to work together to show what climate leadership looks like, both nationally and in the world, and we can do that.
We were talking to Lisa Marshall, advocacy and organizing director for New Yorkers for Clean Power. Thank you so much for talking to me about this really important topic in climate change that's going on in our own state of New York. Thank you so much. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Patricio, for that story. Well, that is absolutely all the time that we have for the local edition tonight. I've been your host, Jason Dole. come back here tomorrow night. I will be back to do it again. We'll be talking to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union. For now, stay with us for The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill.